Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a civic media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations identified Friday a suspected shooter outside of the Centers for Disease Control and Emory University. 30-year-old Patrick Joseph White of Kennesaw, Georgia. A DeKalb County police officer was killed in the shooting. ABC's Faith Abube has more.
According to the CDC, at least four of its buildings were shot in the attack. Adding in a statement, our top priority is the safety and well-being of everyone at CDC. We are actively coordinating with federal, state, and local partners to fully investigate the shooter and this tragic crime.
The shooter was found dead nearby. President Trump will meet in Alaska Friday with Russia's Vladimir Putin. Ukraine will not have a representative there. Today, Ukrainian President Zelensky said any peace deal, not including Ukraine, would lead to, quote, dead solutions. The Texas Attorney General's filed a lawsuit seeking to remove the Democratic House members who left the state to deny a quorum. This is ABC News. The week-long search for an Iraq war veteran suspected of killing four people in a bar in Montana last Friday is over as authorities took Michael Brown into custody Friday afternoon. ABC's Melissa Adon has details.
Montana officials say Brown was armed with a weapon when he was captured outside of the town of Anaconda where the shooting happened. And look, it was a massive manhunt that ensued 1 week ago. From the ground to the sky, all of this after four people were shot to death in a western Montana bar.
Three people were injured in a shooting early this morning in Times Square in New York City. Authorities say the shooting stemmed from a dispute between two teenagers. A 17-year-old has been arrested. Pioneering astronaut Jim Lovell died Thursday, according to NASA. The 97-year-old flew to space four times. He was best known as commander of the Apollo 13 mission that suffered an explosion in space but safely returned to Earth in 1970. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The Todd Allbaugh Show.
I didn't know what the hell Malort was, so here now, our own Carol, head of traffic, she's brought in Malort. Down the hatch, cheers to Malort. Now, it went down fairly smooth, but the back end is ridiculously terrible. Judas Priest, that's terrible. Once is enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like my time with women.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local civic media radio station, and on the app.
Where working people come to talk. It's the Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Join me for an honest approach to the issues American working families care about. No talking points, no focus groups. Get ready for a heavy dose of democracy, fairness, grit, and no apologies. It's current affairs from a working class labor perspective. Facts are center, science is real, and everyone gets a seat at the table. The Rick Smith Show, weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
For Civic Media News, I'm Shelley Pittman. Health researchers are learning more about the human costs linked to transportation emissions. Mike Moen with the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
A new study says the world could prevent nearly 2 million deaths by 2040 if policymakers take a more aggressive and effective approach reducing transportation emissions. A regional health expert also outlines the daily impact in places like Wisconsin. A group of global researchers is out with new findings that say if the status quo remains, tailpipe emissions will double the number of premature deaths and asthma cases in children in underdeveloped areas. Midwest-based doctor Daniel Trajano is with Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate, and he says locally, emissions disrupt day-to-day life for a lot of people.
Other cases, they make you sick enough or you're not breathing well, and you know I got to take several days of school or work off, and that certainly will lead to decreased productivity in the community.
Trajano says air pollution is often associated with large metro areas, but he adds breathing in unhealthy fumes from cars and trucks is a problem in smaller towns and cities, too. He points to kids forced to take longer school bus rides in rural areas, and other studies have found that pollutants can be even more harmful inside a bus. Trajano makes renewed calls for more electric school buses so that kids avoid conditions like asthma and can focus on learning. As for buying an electric car, auto industry analysts say despite sticker shock for some car buyers, EV prices are coming down as technology improves. The authors behind the global study say there needs to be a comprehensive approach to cleaning up the transportation sector beyond sales. The U.S. has made electric vehicle gains but lags behind places like China and Europe. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Find more news anytime at civicmedia.us.
As Wisconsin is cheering on the Brew Crew, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Highs in the upper 80s today, a mix of sun and clouds. It'll be breezy, and the heat index will push into the low to mid 90s. For tonight, showers and storms, lows around 69. Showers and storms on Sunday and highs of 83. Monday, storms in 81. Currently, 78 degrees.
Pete Schwaba. On the next Nightlight, I welcome creator of the show Instability, Fallon Buchholz, and Wisconsin-based comedian Trevor Kumpner joins me in the studio. Can't wait to light up a Monday.
Nightlight with Pete Schwaba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
A new choice, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, WISS.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. Thank you so very much for spending a portion of your weekend in conversation and discussion and absorption of many of these issues related to the rule of law, the administration of justice in our nation. That includes necessarily an awful lot of focus upon our judiciary, the representatives who are serving on our behalf inside important agencies of the United States government, people outside government in other areas that are also on the receiving end of the president's retribution. We know that in addition to all of those folks we talked about in the first hour, including judges, that Jack Smith himself, the former special counsel, the special prosecutor who prosecuted those two cases, one coming out of South Florida involving the president's Mar-a-Lago documents, so to speak, and also that January 6th prosecution, Jack Smith appointed again by the attorney general to do those prosecutions, now himself the target of an investigation by an agency called the Office of Special Counsel. It is independent of the Department of Justice, but how did it get there? It got there because a senator named Tom Cotton, he is from Arkansas, sent a letter to that particular agency saying that Jack Smith's actions in investigating and prosecuting those cases were clearly driven to hurt President Trump's reelection, and also that the actions of Jack Smith are fully actionable and fully accountable. He should be held to a higher level of accountability, according to the senator. The OSC, the Office of Special Counsel, opened this investigation to determine whether or not Jack Smith violated the Hatch Act, which enforces a law that restricts government employees from engaging in political activities. You know that well. The allegation, again, made by a sitting senator of Jack Smith's behavior during the course of his investigation, resulting, for what it's worth, in two grand jury investigations and at least two grand jury indictments. Members of the public finding there is probable cause to believe that the president has engaged in these violations of federal law. Nonetheless, Tom Cotton referring this to the Office of Special Counsel on the basis that Jack Smith has somehow engaged in political activities intended to undermine the political status of candidate Trump at the time, now President Trump, and for that reason should be sanctioned, even though he is no longer in office. The Office of Special Counsel has opened that investigation, again, a part of this attempt to go after those people who have wronged the president in the past, from his view, by virtue of doing the basic job duties and responsibilities that have been assigned to them. It is a source, should be a source, of dramatic concern and consternation and disappointment, dismay, objection by all Americans, because we are now targeting people who've done their jobs for retributive actions. We appreciate so much the the comments and the contributions of all of our listeners, including Gary, from Madison, who writes, this administration's weaponizing the judicial department will only destroy everyone's civil rights. And that's the concern. By having these petitions, these attempts to try to stop federal judges from doing their jobs, you're therefore having a direct, not indirect, but a direct effect upon the capacity of the judges to do their jobs undeterred by these frivolous and unsupported allegations. Mark also writes, he writes, how smart is it to fire people who likely have seen incriminating evidence about you, about Donald Trump in particular? And he also bemoans the fact that this is going on. All of that happening in the United States of America, much of it just this past week, investigations, ethics complaints, firings of people who in the past have engaged in legitimate actions in their various positions, a source of great concern, not only here on this broadcast, but for all Americans going ahead. A programming note at this point early in our second hour, and that is what's going to be happening in our next broadcast next weekend. We are approaching once again that time when the Supreme Court is going to be back in action, if you will, entertaining oral arguments in October of this year. We know that they've got about 30 cases already on their docket, and that includes cases involving voting rights and transgender sports and campaign finance and conversion therapy and, yes, indeed, abortion. All of those and about 25 other matters pending before the Supreme Court already. Next weekend, we're going to be spending some time talking about the group of cases the Supreme Court has already undertaken to review in this coming term. Lots on our agenda for that next weekend broadcast. Lots on our agenda for this hour as well. This hour as well. We turn now to federal district court judges who, again, have been under fire by this administration by entering various injunctions, doing various things that are a part of their duties and responsibilities. And these are judges that have been appointed by Democrats and Republicans alike. We have had district court judges, appellate court judges who have sometimes declined to enjoin the president from doing things, often, more often, enjoining him, stopping him, at least by virtue of their orders and their directives, stopping him from engaging in many of the kinds of things that he wants to do through these various executive orders that he has entered. Let's talk about more of those that have happened just in recent days. Let's talk about a federal district court judge who has ruled that the administration's abrupt elimination of some arts funding, some humanitarian grants that were previously approved by, yes, that's right, by the Congress, are unlawful. And that a lawsuit that's brought to challenge that action by the administration to stop those arts funding pockets from going ahead, that those can move forward. The lawsuits challenging those do indeed have some reason for being pursued. In April, the group led by Elon Musk terminated some grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities to thousands of groups nationwide. And those involved humanities councils, museums, historic sites, archives, libraries, educators, media outlets, all sorts of things going on out there receiving these funds and now terminated by virtue of the president's executive order. What happens just this past week is U.S. District Judge Michael Simon, he writes that the councils were likely to succeed on their claim that the withholding of the funds at issue in this case is unconstitutional. He says the United States Constitution exclusively grants the power of the purse to the Congress and not to the president. He also goes on to say that federal funding for the arts and the humanities has enjoyed bipartisan support for decades, with Congress continuing to strengthen the statutes governing these authorities, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and provide stable funding generation after generation, supporting the injunction against that. Plainly, subject to further review, district court action, federal appeals court action, but a federal judge rules that these cuts to the humanities, these grants given them previously, are unlawful. that coming out of the pen and off the desk of U.S. District Judge Michael Simon just this past week. Another completely different area, but one that's much more in the news. This is alligator Alcatraz. We've got a judge. Her name is Kathleen Williams. She is in the Federal District Court in Miami. That's South Florida. She issues a temporary restraining order from the bench saying that the state of Florida cannot install any more lighting and paving and fencing or other fixtures at this detention center that has been dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. It plainly is the place where great numbers of people facing deportation are being and will be housed, will be incarcerated pending those proceedings. The order is in a place for about 14 days. It gives the judge some time to complete a hearing on the case. It's brought by several environmental groups. And yes, indeed, there's other litigation pending attacking the civil rights processing, the due process of the people at that detention facility. This one is about environmental matters. They're arguing that this project to build this facility near the Everglades there, run by the state, but housing federal immigration detainees, that the very construction of this is going ahead without first completing an environmental review. And that's required by federal law. You know that well. You've heard about this a lot in the past. The groups are therefore seeking from Judge Williams a preliminary injunction to stop the operation and the construction of the center itself. And the communications director, of course, from the governor's office has responded to this temporary suspension of construction with dismay and with disagreement. He said that the detainees there would remain in the detention center. And he said the ruling suspending construction there would have no impact on immigration enforcement in Florida. The judge has been hearing testimony in this case for a day and a half before ruling from the bench. The reason for her temporary restraining order is that the plaintiffs here provided information that there were dozens of trucks carrying what appeared to be fill, as well as a soil compactor driving into the detention center as recently as the last couple of days, continued construction on the site. And the result of all of that testimony is that the judge said, while we're going on and determining whether the merits of this case are there sufficient to enter a preliminary injunction, she says that the construction has to halt in the meantime while we figure out what's going on here. The government lawyers declined to make a commitment to stop the construction, and so Judge Williams, from the bench, here's arguments, and she says that I'm now going to issue orally the argument, or rather the order, to stop the construction. It is temporary, but it is a pause on the further destruction of this sensitive area to allow the parties to further present evidence to Judge Williams as this matter goes forward. Interestingly, Judge Williams also previously held a fellow named James Uthmeyer, who's the state's attorney general and the governor's former chief of staff, in civil contempt for defying her order in another case that blocked enforcement of a provision in the state immigration law. So she has had some previous experience in all of this. The environmental case, of course, as I said, is one of a couple of them that are focusing upon this particular Alligator Alcatraz facility. There's another one that attacks the due process rights of the detainees there and relates to their civil and constitutional rights. The lawyers for the Department of Justice, the federal folks in this, have tried to distance themselves from all of this by saying the detention center is being constructed by state authorities and its location suggests that, and therefore the feds are not involved in this. Well, plainly, federal detainees are being placed there. Difficult to make that argument. But the judge, again, just this past week, ordering the construction of that, continued construction of that facility to be suspended there at Alligator Alcatraz in Florida. We've got more judges, as we know, who are entering orders with respect to birthright citizenship. We know that the Supreme Court, in one of its last orders of this
season of this year, if you will, this term, the Supreme Court decided specifically not to decide whether or not the president's executive order on birthright citizenship should be upheld or not. Instead, they focused upon this national injunction notion that judges do not have the capacity, whatever their final ruling is, to make it effective for all of the nation or certainly for areas beyond their particular jurisdictions. When we come back, I'll tell you about yet another judge in the wake of that order who's entered an order in this area. And we'll talk more about that. It comes from a judge in Maryland. We'll talk about what she did this past week as Amicus Law Review continues.
.3 and 96.5 WISS, home of Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
There was a time when barbecue was perfect. A strong, reliable flavor that could be counted on. But then big manufacturers decided that barbecue needed to be zesty or spicy or sweeter or whatever. If you miss the good old days of great-tasting barbecue, we'd like to introduce you to Grandpa's Barbecue. Made in small batches from Grandpa's original recipe. Buy yours online today at grandpasbarbecueshop.com.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. With sinking approval ratings and the 2026 midterms looming, President Donald Trump asked Texas legislators to further gerrymander congressional maps and preserve a GOP advantage in the U.S. House. Sinking to the challenge, Democratic states are threatening to cheat in their states, too. States rarely redistrict mid-decade. Trump's unfavorable ratings reached 56% in a July 28th Economist YouGov poll, and with only a 219 to 212 GOP advantage in the U.S. House, Trump asked the Texas legislature for help. The GOP already has 25 of the state's 38 U.S. House seats, but July 30th, the legislature unveiled a map targeting Democratic districts in Austin, Dallas, Houston, and South Texas to gain an extra 5 GOP seats, according to the Texas Tribune. Ohio, another GOP-dominated state, is also redistricting, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis suggested his state's congressional map may have, quote, defects that need to be remedied. Leaders in blue states, including California, Illinois, Maryland, and New York, have threatened to counteract gerrymandered GOP gains. While California Governor Gavin Newsom threatened, his state uses a constitutionally protected independent redistricting commission, as do six other blue states, making it harder to game the system. We have all our Redistricting Week reports at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
I was stuck in a state of panic and endless rituals, so I made the call.
Mental health care works when you make the call. Visit mentalhealthcareworks.org. A message from the American Psychiatric Association Foundation.
As Wisconsin is saying the word bag instead of bag, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about, once again, as we often do, the injunction function of federal district court judges. Judge finding that the president's attempt to cut arts funding is unconstitutional. That alligator Alcatraz, that facility in South Florida, the construction there has got to stop. We've got more judges who are entering orders preventing the president's executive order on birthright citizenship from going into effect. Once again, we know well what the recent history of this was. Supreme Court, in its decision of late June, talked all about the incapacity, the lack of power of federal judges to impose nationwide injunctions. Can't tell everybody across the entire nation what to do coming from your particular district. That applies plainly to any orders related to birthright citizenship or other things generally. That came out of Amy Coney Barrett's pen. They specifically decided at that time not to wrestle with and not to address, not to resolve whether or not the underlying order, whether the president was right in restricting birthright citizenship based upon whether or not your parents were here legally or here temporarily. They didn't decide that issue. And so sure enough,
Sure enough, federal district court judges taking up the Supreme Court's language, and they're deciding the case. We know from our previous reporting that in the wake of what Amy Coney Barrett wrote for the majority, you had District Judge Joseph LaPlante. He's from New Hampshire. He says, you know what? If class actions are still available, that's what I'm going to do. He says that he's identified a class of all the babies who are born since mid-February or so in the wake of the president's executive order. All of them who'd be aggrieved by this particular executive order, they're a class. He certifies them, and he says, as to them, they're all citizens. That, again, taking up the language of the Supreme Court that says that class actions may still be available, even though national injunctions may not be. We talked also about this judge. His name is Leo Sorokin. He's in Massachusetts. He's done basically the same thing. He said, you know what? The injunctive relief that he granted to about a dozen states remains effective. Likewise, in the wake of the Supreme Court's order not deciding on this issue of birthright citizenship. And just this past week, we've got another judge, not at all unexpected. Her name is Deborah Boardman. She is in Maryland. And just this past week, she has followed the lead, if you will, of her colleagues. And she has likewise entered a preliminary injunction against the enforcement of the executive order. She also says the same thing, that she certifies a class, as does Judge LaPlante, and that class is all children who have been born or will be born in the United States after February 19th who would be affected by Donald Trump's order. She said the plaintiffs in the lawsuit before her were extremely likely to win their argument that the birthright citizenship order violates the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Of course, that language, including a citizenship clause, says that all people born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the U.S. Jurisdiction of the United States are indeed citizens. They were also likely to suffer irreparable harm, according to Judge Boardman, if the order went into effect. She now enters yet another injunction against this. We've got more and more judges around the country doing what the Supreme Court has not done, not in defiance of the Supreme Court, but certainly taking up on the language built into that order, saying that there are other remedies, and the judges seizing on that and doing what the Supreme Court failed to do. It is interesting to note that in the wake of all of these judicial actions at the lower court levels, finding that the president's executive order is unconstitutional, is illegal, cannot go into effect as to these babies born in recent weeks and months, that the Department of Justice has said, we're going to pursue this with the Supreme Court. We're going to go back and seek from the Supreme Court a definitive decision, which they did not rule on, about whether or not the president's executive order is in place. Again, the contests, the challenges continue inside and certainly outside of the federal judiciary as all of this goes ahead. We're going to talk more about that in just a few minutes when we talk about some of the internal dissension inside the federal judiciary as well, internal to federal district court judges, some appeals court judges, and yes, indeed, the Supreme Court itself, when we talk about the fabric of the rule of law, again, unwinding and diminished as our nation continues to witness all of this. I'm going to talk about one more injunction that also comes right out of our own state of Wisconsin. This is the U.S. District Court in the Western District of Wisconsin, and it comes from the pen of a federal judge. And he has made a major determination just this past week about the homeowners' rights and the rights of an Ojibwe tribe with respect to a long-standing roads dispute on the Lac du Flambeau Reservation. Judge Conley, Judge William Conley, who is a federal district court judge again in Madison, that's the Western District of Wisconsin, has declared that dozens of homeowners within who've gotten property, private property over time, lawfully purchased this private property on the Lac du Flambeau Reservation, do in fact have the right to access, unfettered access to their land, using four disputed roads that run across tribal land. And of course, all this relates to issues of sovereignty and agreements made with tribal populations around the nation, including the Lac du Flambeau Reservation and the Ojibwe tribe in particular. The tribal authorities had barricaded these roads for several weeks in 2023. They said that attempts to renegotiate some easement agreements that had been longstanding for the roads to be used by these private citizens who do indeed have private property inside the properties and the reservation of the tribe. They said they tried to pursue those and they were ignored by the non-tribal town officials and title insurance companies that manage those particular properties. The case goes into court. Tribal officials say in that context that the roads had been illegally built decades ago and that the non-tribal residents, who again have these private parcels of land inside the reservation, were therefore trespassing across those tribal lands for at least about 10 years after the easements that were granted to them had expired. When we come back, I'll tell you what Judge Conley did in that case, a major case not only for the reservation, for the tribal authorities, for the tribal members, for the residents there, but for all of us concerned about our state, our nation, and issues related to our Native American populations. That coming back here on Amicus, a Law Review.
From Oshkosh to Nina, this is 98.3 WISS.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The Georgia Bureau of Investigations identified Friday a suspected shooter outside of the Centers for Disease Control and Emory University. It's 30-year-old Patrick Joseph White of Kennesaw, Georgia. A DeKalb County police officer was killed in the shooting. ABC's Faith Abube has more.
According to the CDC, at least four of its buildings were shot in the attack. Adding in a statement, our top priority is the safety and well-being of everyone at CDC. We are actively coordinating with federal, state, and local partners to fully investigate the shooter and this tragic crime.
The shooter was found dead nearby. President Trump will meet in Alaska Friday with Russia's Vladimir Putin. Ukraine will not have a representative there. Today, Ukrainian President Zelensky said any peace deal, not including Ukraine, would lead to, quote, dead solutions. The Texas Attorney General's filed a lawsuit seeking to remove the Democratic House members who left the state to deny a quorum. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin is hitting the road on your Harley, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Brewers host the Mets. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports baseball. It's the Brewers and the Mets tonight at American Family Field. Last night, the crew held on to win 3-2 thanks to an incredible throw from Blake Perkins in center field to catcher William Contreras to throw out the tying run. FanDuel Wisconsin.
Two outs in the ninth, and McNeil into center field, a base hit. Perkins throw to the plate. Throws a 97-mile-an-hour fastball to home plate to end the game.
The Brewers' Blake Perkins, after producing the final out.
Yeah, I was fired up, man. I mean, an exciting game, super competitive. Obviously, we have some history with these guys, and it feels incredible.
NFL, Packers host the Jets tonight in preseason football. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
As Wisconsin is cheering on Bucky Badger, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Highs in the upper 80s today, a mix of sun and clouds. It'll be breezy, and the heat index will push into the low to mid 90s. For tonight, showers and storms, lows around 69. Showers and storms on Sunday and highs of 83. Monday, storms in 81.
Right now, it's 80.
Keeping you connected to your local community with real news and great conversation. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
The 174-year-old Wisconsin State Fair is underway and is a finalist for USA Today's 10 Best list. Could it be the Cream Puffs? Here's Christy Chuckle with the fair.
The Cream Puff was created to showcase the dairy industry in Wisconsin.
The story of Cream Puffs never gets old, and now renovations of the former Cream Puff Pavilion, renamed the Dairy Building, will show off a new kitchen and more.
Watch them being made right there, right before you buy them. That's why they're so delicious.
The bakers known as Team Cream Puff will be able to crank out more than 400,000 during the fair. They're even adding chocolate cream puffs for the first time. And it turns out there's a secret to eating them.
Just twist, open it. It doesn't necessarily squish all over, but some people just like to go for it.
So go for it and enjoy the tasty history of the state fair. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. If you're looking for honest talk, real stories, and straight-up news that matters to you, tune in to The Rick Smith Show. We're digging into the issues that affect your job, your family, your future. Join me weeknights at 9 on the Civic Media Radio Network, because your voice deserves to be heard. That's The Rick Smith Show, heard weeknights at 9 right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Todd Alba.
Hey, everybody. Join us next time. Take a look back at the big sports events. The Packers kick off the preseason, and the Brewers try to continue the winning streak, and a little news as well. Join us.
The Todd Alba Show, weekdays 2 to 4.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. We are talking about injunctions once again here on our weekend broadcast, and particularly focusing upon this very significant order entered by Judge William Conley. He's a federal district court judge in the Western District of Wisconsin, located in Madison. He has before him this challenge, this fight, this disagreement between the Lac-Du-Flambeau tribe and the members of another portion of the litigation, the plaintiffs who are seeking to retain access to their private properties they purchased or their predecessors purchased many years ago that also are inside the confines, the outer borders of the reservation there. And so we have just this past week in this contest, this challenge between the two, U.S. District Judge William Conley ordering permanent public access for roads that go through land that is indeed owned by the Lac-Du-Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, and directing that the private property owners inside that reservation, for their parcels, they can in fact get access to those. What has happened, of course, in the past is that the tribes, maintaining their sovereignty, maintaining that under previous arrangements with the federal government, this is their land, they had begun to blockade those roads when the failure to go ahead on negotiating easements, that is, opportunities and mechanisms for those private property owners to get access over the lands of the tribe, when those opportunities, those negotiations failed, they put up these barricades and said no more. And that prompted the litigation. And again, it's all about property. It's about property rights and access and things like easements. But it's also about larger issues related to sovereignty. And we know that the nations, the federally recognized tribes here in Wisconsin, there are 11 of them, many, many others recognized by the federal government throughout our nation. It is all about sovereignty, and they remain sovereign nations inside our country. Judge William Conley, along the way, wrestling with some of the historical legislation, including a thing called the Indian Right of Way Act. Interestingly, the United States of America, the Department of Justice, joining with the tribes in contending that the town's use and the use by the property owner's maintenance of the road is a trespass because it lacks a valid, unexpired right of way under this Indian Right of Way Act. 50 homeowners there who rely on the roads to reach their property also intervened as defendants in this case. Lots and lots of litigation going on. In the end, the judge, among other things, in his 47-page opinion, it is exhaustive. And yes, indeed, as I often do, I commend your reading of it, because it is a judge wrestling with difficult issues, addressing the legislation, addressing the equities, if you will, addressing the history of our relationship and our interconnection with our Native American populations here in Wisconsin and also throughout our nation. In the end, he notes this, among other things. He says, neither the United States nor the tribe have attempted to impose reasonable restrictions
on the homeowners or town's access, perhaps inviting some future negotiation and involvement between the two of them. He says, instead, to date, the tribe has attempted to block access altogether and demanded that the town pay an exorbitant monthly fee to keep the roads open or a one-time $20 million fee for permanent public access. Accordingly, the judge says, the court concludes the town and the homeowners have an implied easement, applied access to use and even access the roads to reach their homes and their properties. 47 pages of writing by this federal judge wrestling with all of this. Plainly, it is not the end. We do have statements from the tribe indicating that they will continue to defend their tribal lands and uphold the promises they said made to treaties with the United States of the United States of America, saying they're disappointed by the outcome, concerned about the precedent this decision may, in fact, set for tribal governments across the country. That from Lac du Flambeau President John Johnson. Nonetheless, he said, we will carefully review the decision and consider all available options. One of those plainly would be taking the case up to appeal. That would go to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. That's the next higher court here in our part of the world. Arguably going back to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court should choose to pursue that as well. A very interesting, a fascinating case involving all of those issues, statutory issues, historical issues, constitutional issues. We know that Native American rights appear in our Constitution. All of that commended to your attention and reading as you consider these very difficult issues, these very challenging issues about the relationship between our laws, our commitments in the past, our commitments to the present, to our tribal populations in our state and beyond. We're going to talk, as promised, about some of the larger consequences, some of them unseen, as a result of all of these compromises and infringements on the rule of law in America. I promise we talk about judges, both internal to the judiciary, judges in connection with their relationship to the Department of Justice lawyers, and indeed, the relationship the Department of Justice has with the public in general. Let's talk in the wake of those discussions about some of those earlier injunctions we talked about just a few moments ago. Let's talk about what's happening, first of all, inside the judiciary itself. Lots of headlines out there indicating that federal judges keep defying the Supreme Court. And that may or may not be a phrase, a verb that you yourself might embrace. But the reality is that federal judges are finding ways to push back on what they feel are the inappropriate, arguably illegal positions of the Supreme Court. We talked about three of those already. Finding, that is the judges finding, ways in which to find that the president's executive order on birthright citizenship cannot stand. Supreme Court didn't decide that. They're invoking the language of the Supreme Court order to say, okay, if in fact we can't do that as a national injunction, we'll certify a class and do it that way and get around this problem that you've identified. There are many other instances of the same kind of thing. Here are some of them that I pulled from my own research and review. U.S. District Judge Gia Cobb has blocked the Trump administration just this past week from using a process known as expedited removal. We've talked about this in the past, to quickly remove illegal immigrants from the country. The order could, at least for the time being, dramatically curtail the White House's ability to carry out some of its components of the deportation agenda. Public statement about the ruling, the administration says that this judge is defying a previous Supreme Court ruling. Judge Cobb, the administration says, is flagrantly ignoring the United States Supreme Court, which upheld expedited removal of illegal aliens by a 7-2 majority. We talked about that case. The ruling is lawless, the administration says, and won't stand. Similar cases where the lower courts have likewise chipped away at what the Supreme Court has done are out there. We recall well Brian Murphy, another instance here. He's in the Federal District Court in Massachusetts. He issued a preliminary injunction in April against the transfer of those deportable illegal migrants. Remember, these are the convicted criminals. They're dangerous people. They should be deported, but not afforded due process about where they go, to third countries, not of their origin. And he says you can't do that until you afford them the due process. The judge decided that his order remained in effect even after the Supreme Court issued a stay, a suspension of his order. Judge Murphy invokes the language of the dissenter, Sonia Sotomayor, and he says that her language permits him nonetheless to support what he said before. The Trump administration then refers to Brian Murphy's action as unprecedented defiance of the Supreme Court's authority. Maybe, maybe not. In yet another case, this one involving the comments again by the Solicitor General and others, Supreme Court ruled in an administration's favor in a 7-2 decision in July, allowing the Trump administration to deport a group of migrants to South Sudan. And that is why, once again, in the wake of that, Judge Murphy goes back and he says, well, they didn't specifically prohibit me from doing what I am saying here. And Solicitor General John Sauer says that the district's ruling that follows that all that Supreme Court action disrupts the sensitive diplomatic relations, slams the brakes on the executive's lawful efforts to effectuate third country removals back and forth. District court judges, according to the administration, not following what the Supreme Court's saying, but according to them, saying, no, we're doing what the Supreme Court has said according to its language. We've got another one. Here's Michael Simon once again, and we've talked about him previously. We have talked about the fact that he is in the District of Oregon. He has ruled in July that the Department of Homeland Security could not engage in wide-scale parole status termination for migrants. This is the case we chatted about just a few moments ago. In May, the Supreme Court had quashed many of those orders from another federal district court, and that had likewise blocked President Trump's dismissal of two members of that entity. And once again, we've got the Supreme Court staying previous decisions over the objection of district courts. In other circumstances, you've got the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals choosing not to stay a district court order that enjoined the presidential removal, remember this, of members of the Consumer Product Safety Commission and another agency, obviously the Merit Systems Protection Board. In July, the Supreme Court granted the stay, citing a previous order as precedent. The Trump administration likewise objecting to all of this, the upshot of all of this. And yes, indeed, it's a lot. It is a lot, including these birthright citizenship orders, is you've got federal district court judges in the wake of the Supreme Court issuing orders, variously staying or at least issuing orders commenting on the subject matter of their administration of cases in their courts. Supreme Court saying things, the district court in the wake of that saying, we hear you. We understand what you have articulated. Nonetheless, we're going to go ahead and do what we think our prior order contemplated. We don't think it violates what you, Supreme Court justices, have said, and therefore we're going to reaffirm what we've done before. The administration goes back to the Supreme Court and says, tell this lower court to do what you said in some instances. Yes, indeed. The Supreme Court does, in fact, grant that subsequent order, but you've got this sparring going back, which we have not seen in these numbers with this kind of particularity. And all those four instances or so and more that I've articulated here, and yes, indeed, it's a lot. It's a lot to consume in even one broadcast. The upshot of it is this fraying of matters even inside the federal judiciary. District court judges entering orders, having them be the subject of Supreme Court rulings, some of them in the emergency docket, which also causes a huge problem. That's the issue with the Judge Brian Murphy matter in Massachusetts. This back and forth, this sparring between them, again, prompting headlines like judges keep defying the Supreme Court, requiring the Supreme Court go back and forth and telling those lower court judges to hold the line and follow what they have said, sometimes with the support and the following of the district court judges, sometimes not. This birthright citizenship matter promises to raise the issue once again, especially with respect to these judges who are out there finding that the president's executive order is unconstitutional. If indeed the administration is successful in getting another hearing before the Supreme Court, Supreme Court issues an order one way or the another on birthright citizenship, it will be fascinating to see what the lower courts do after having entered this entire series of orders now saying that it is in fact unconstitutional. Supreme Court agrees with that. No issue. Supreme Court says, indeed, the executive order is constitutional. Then we may have more sparring internal to the federal judiciary in 2025. When we come back, we'll talk about relations between the courts and the Department of Justice and the Department of Justice and you as the public as Amicus Law Review continues.
Rebuilding and refreshing local radio one station at a time. This Civic Media radio station is proud to be a part of your community. Learn more at civicmedia.us.
Hey, it's Amanda, and we all know that Northeast Wisconsin has some of the best events around, but trying to find them all can be a little tricky. So here at WISS, we decided to do the work for you. Prevent boredom on any night by going to WISS.FM and click events in the top right corner. You'll never have to spend forever scrolling to find out what's going on in your area. And if you've got an event to share, hit us up. Email info@WISS.FM. We can work together to have real news and great conversation while giving you the 411 on what's happening in New Wisco.
I'm Dan Schaefer. Let's recombobulate. With Governor Tony Evers choosing not to run for a third term, that means we're going to have the first open race for governor in 16 years. We already know who some of the candidates will be. On the Democratic side, Lieutenant Governor Sarah Rodriguez launched her campaign, and Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley said he's running. On the Republican side, Washington County Executive Josh Shulman and Southeastern Wisconsin Business Executive Bill Berrien are running. Many more are expected to join the race. And it's not just governor that will have an open race. We could see open races for attorney general, lieutenant governor, secretary of state, and state treasurer, too. Couple that with what's happening in the state legislature, no longer under gerrymandered maps, the year 2026 is going to bring a rather unique moment for voters in Wisconsin to determine the path forward on a fresh new era for the state. I know some can be wary of change, but let's embrace this as the real opportunity that it is.
Find all of Dan's work at the Recombobulation Area. Matt Nair on air.
Here's my gripe. MTV made it possible for really subpar performers to become stars. Madonna would never have been a star if it hadn't been for MTV and her grinding her way across the floor in a wedding dress.
See, that's where I think your gripe isn't with MTV. I think your gripe is with Madonna grinding on MTV.
Thank you, Matt from Richland Center. How dare you, Jane?
Matt Nair on air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. The Todd Allbaugh Show.
Laura McCoy, she is a member of the Green Bay School Board.
In the 1990s, revenue caps were put into place, and Green Bay was a conservative, low-spending district. Mm-hmm. We've been struggling with that basically ever since. The people in our community have stepped up again and again to pass referendums. That's wonderful, but we need that per-pupil increase. We need the cash to keep the lights on, basically, and to pay our staff what they deserve.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays 2 to 4 on your local Civic Media radio station, and on the app.
For 75 years, the Muscular Dystrophy Association's voices have thundered through the halls of Congress.
For 75 years, we've willed the impossible into existence.
For 75 years, the MDA community has pushed the science,
shifted the narrative,
and established the field of neuromuscular medicine.
And until that day, when this is all a thing of the past,
you couldn't stop us if you tried.
Join us and celebrate 75 years of breakthroughs at mda75.org.
Join the family. Civic Media has a number of great jobs across the state. Open now at civicmedia.us/careers.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santelis. We talk about the ways in which the rule of law is fraying, even inside the federal judiciary, these judges out there, not just in connection with birthright citizenship, but all sorts of other matters, beginning to tell the United States Supreme Court that we're not going to follow, or at least we're going to find ways to get around what you have directed in many of these areas. It is not a good sign, regardless of how you feel about the merits of the cases in front of them. This is not a good sign, and it's another indication of the diminution of the rule of law, even inside the judiciary itself. There is a concept, which I promised at the top of our broadcast this week, called departmentalism. What's that all about? And it basically says this: the president can still ignore a judicial order that, on the president's independent interpretation, exceeds the scope of judicial power. When a district court, for example, enters an order, the basic theory of this thing called departmentalism is that while the Supreme Court has the authority to exercise Article III judicial power in cases or controversies, the president's Article II duty to take care that the law be faithfully executed gives him an independent power to determine what the law is, including what the Constitution says, what legislation says. It is a theory that, once again, is out there. It is concerning for many reasons, because, once again, it would seemingly put the president above the courts, the lower courts, the Supreme Court. And it is now being discussed in the context of these so-called defying judges. Can the president invoke the concept of departmentalism to say, in the end, it doesn't matter, I'm going to do what I think is right? Further underscoring the great concern about the balance of power, the checks and balances between the branches of government. Departmentalism, something you should know about, may be, again, on the lips of our president, even the attorney general, when these continued attempts to effectuate things that are unconstitutional animate our lives and livelihoods. Let's talk about another aspect of this and another concept out there, and that is called the presumption of regularity. The presumption of regularity. Justice Department lawyers like me for many, many years have enjoyed what's called a professional benefit when they appear in court. Nothing inappropriate, nothing illegal, but basically the notion is that judges tend to take prosecutors and government lawyers at their word. We rely upon the truth, the veracity, the ethical integrity that you bring to this presentation, to your argument to me, and assuming that the Department of Justice lawyers are indeed telling the truth. But in the past several months, as we have seen in many of these cases, as President Trump's Justice Department, the lawyers who appear in these cases have misled the courts, violated their orders, even demonized judges. We've talked already this broadcast alone about the name calling and the other things that have come in the wake of this sparring between the attorneys for the Department of Justice and these lawyers, many looking to determine whether or not this presumption of regularity still applies, that when judges have in front of them an attorney of the Department of Justice, are those judges still going to place credence, take them at their word, assume they're telling the truth, and give them the presumption of regularity? Well, for example, in June, when an order was unsealed in federal district court in Washington showing Magistrate Judge Zia Faruqui all that she needed, presumably needed to know about unsealing this, she ripped into some prosecutors there after trying to convince her, to convince him, that he needed to be highly deferential to their request to keep a search warrant sealed. Blind deference to the government, Judge Faruqui wrote, that is no longer a thing. Trust has been earned over generations, and that has been lost. After all, the judge pointed out, the Department of Justice lawyers under Donald Trump have done much, she said, to destroy the confidence normally afforded them in court. After Paula Zinnes has had the latest exchange in her courtroom, again involving Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia. We've talked a lot about that case, the immigrant who was wrongfully deported to El Salvador, now in federal custody in the Middle District of Tennessee. After a recent hearing there, Judge Zinnes spent weeks, and her hearing followed weeks of her trying to get the Department of Justice lawyers to give us straightforward information about her questions, about the status of this case. She finally loses patience, and she says, this has been the process from day one. You have taken the presumption of regularity, she uses that term in particular, and you've destroyed it in my view. In April, recall Judge Dale Ho. He's in the Federal District Court in Manhattan. He rejected this false representation by the Department of Justice that was given reasons for dismissing those bribery charges. Remember those against Mayor Eric Adams of New York? Judge Ho eventually does indeed throughout the charges, he feels obliged to do that. But along the way, he criticizes the department. He says it appears as though the officials have used their power in a quid pro quo with Adams to get him to support Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. Everything here, the judge says, smacks of a bargain dismissal of the indictment in exchange for immigration policy concessions, again, suggesting the presumption of regularity no longer applies. There's a federal judge on Long Island. He refuses just last month to take the department's word after prosecutors ask her to dismiss an indictment against Vladimir Chavez. He's a leader of the violent street gang MS-13 before sending him back to El Salvador. Instead of accepting the government's assertion that the case against Chavez needed to be tossed out because of national security concerns, the judge there likewise says, I need to know more about that. Her name is Joan Azrak. She orders the government to tell her more about the politics behind the case. And again, she is not pursuing the presumption of regularity, requiring the government to disclose a whole lot more about the relationship between the administration and El Salvador. All of these kinds of things suggesting once again that this presumption of regularity no longer exists. Next, we're going to talk more about that and even how federal grand juries more and more suggesting that they're not doing exactly what the government may want. We'll talk also about the public interaction with all of this as Amicus Law Review continues next week here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Join us for all of that and have a good weekend.
This is WISS Berlin Oshkosh and WZBU New Holstein Appleton, the Fox Valley's real news and great conversation, a Civic Media station.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. The CDC commissioner says at least four CDC buildings at headquarters in Atlanta were hit by gunfire in Friday's shooting. Authorities have now identified the shooter as a 30-year-old from suburban Atlanta, but they've not commented on a motive. Meanwhile, the remembrances are beginning for police officer David Rose, who was killed in that shooting.
He was committed to serving the community. At this time, we're asking for the community's prayers for his family, his friends, his loved ones, and the entire DeKalb County Police Department family.
That's DeKalb County Interim Police Chief Greg Pedrick. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on social media he's been speaking with world leaders today. He will not be speaking at Friday's meeting between President Trump and Russia's Vladimir Putin. That'll take place in Alaska. Zelensky's rejected President Trump's suggestion that both sides might give up territory as part of a peace agreement. This is ABC News.